It's the voice of Noel Garcia, their song, I Thank You, Lord. Before that, from Phil Driscoll, Your Every Breath I Take. We heard two from Amy Grant, Joyful, Joyful, We Adore Thee. 11 minutes after the hour on a Tuesday morning here along the Broken Road. We're in the Lake region of East Dakota, somewhere, we're surrounded by Minnesota. That'll give you a clue as to where to find us on the map. In the meantime, Dr. Don Clark, our resident biochemist, member of the Board of Creation Moments, is in Garden Valley, Texas, which is about 90 miles east of Dallas. And my guess is you've got you're headed for sunshine and 70 today, maybe? Maybe
not? Oh, not today. No. Temperature has dropped, as it's probably dropped and dropped, all over the country, at least the eastern half and central part of the country. Yeah. It's probably in the 30s right now.
Sympathy just pours out for you here.
It's cold. Well, I don't know how we're going to survive
this weather. On all your grapes in your vineyard out there and keep warm, little electric heaters out there.
That's brutal. Mm-hmm. I moved south for the winter. Oh, Amy, you are south.
Don up here, February comes, and sometimes we see temperatures in the mid-20s. We throw off our coats and run outside and go, freedom.
Yeah. If it's any consolation, it will get up probably in the 50s, if not low 60s today.
All right,
so when the sun starts coming out, which it's about ready to do, it starts warming up.
You've got sunshine? Mm-hmm. I haven't seen the sun in days. Weeks, it seems, around here.
I got some down here.
Do you? Okay. Mm-hmm. That's promising then.
It's far away to the south.
Yeah. Don joins us weekly on Tuesday mornings, and we typically talk about faith and science and creation and Genesis and lots of that kind of thing. Don, a board member, at Creation Moments. There's an article that we ran across at the Institute of Creation Research by Dr. Tim Clary, and it relates dinosaur fossils and flood rocks. Or sedimentary layers. Now, most of it, I think it's common knowledge that there are certain areas of the United States, at least, where there are great numbers of dinosaur fossils being found. Montana is the first place that comes to mind. I'm struggling with his last name. Mark? Who was Mark? Mark? Don? What's the scientist, soft tissue and dinosaurs? I caught you too,
Armitage.
Didn't I? Mark Armitage. There you
That's
go. Located a dinosaur, I think it was a Triceratops horn, and found soft tissue in it. We talked about that with Mark on the air about a year ago now. But he found this thing in Montana where there's a great collection of thousands of dinosaur fossils, and a similar collection exists up farther north in Alberta, Canada. And I'm often wondered, how is it that dinosaur bones are found in such great concentrations? Something in history must have resulted in, forced that to happen, caused that to happen. Don, any clues from this article?
Oh, there's a tremendous number of clues from this article.
Well, I'm counting on it.
You have to change your thinking. Mm-hmm. This is, from an evolutionary point of view, where the sedimentary layers that we see, not only across the United States but all of Europe and pretty much all over the world. Was not a result of a slow process, but was the result of a catastrophe. And the catastrophe, of course, is the Great Flood. Noah didn't cause the flood, but his name's attributed to it, because he and his family actually lived through the flood because they built an ark. If you look at this, and this article is focused primarily on America, a couple of things stand out. First, if you look at the sedimentary layers, across the United States, they're thicker on the East Coast, and then there's some later deposits that get pretty thick on the West Coast. But the sedimentary layers in the central part of the United States, and of course it goes up into Canada, is much thinner. And we're talking about on the East Coast, for example, it can be as thick, greater than 2 miles thick. Hmm. That's a lot of sediment.
Yeah,
where did it? The first question you have to ask is, how did all that sediment get there? And of course, the flood model explains it, you know, quite well, in that, you know, before the flood, you know, the Earth was one landmass, or commonly called Pangaea, the supercontinent. And then sometime, you know, during the flood, the landmass started to break up into the continents we have today.
And we should say that both evolutionists and creationists look at that and agree, don't they, that there was a single landmass called Pangaea.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And you can, as we've talked about, I think on other programs here, that you can tie the two continents, for example, the eastern part of the United States with the western part of Europe, for example. You can tie that together very nicely with, you know, Earth cores. You can find out that, gee, the layers are the same. You know, everything is.
Even just looking at the general outlines of the continent, seem like they're pieces of a puzzle that were once together.
Right, and that's where the theory actually first came from, because a geologist did that and said, "Oh, looks like maybe these things were one piece at one time." Mm-hmm. Well,
I thought you said I found the corner.
Yeah, I found. Anyway, as these continents were drifting apart, of course, we've had a whole bunch of upheaval on Earth. I mean, you can imagine the volcanic activity, for example, that was taking place as the seafloor began to form between the Americas and the Europe. And that, you know, in itself created huge tidal waves.
Well, there are entire mountain ranges that rose under the ocean. So, yeah.
And anyway, I mean, you can easily, not easily, but I mean, you can contribute the sediments that we see to a lot of water activity. And I'm talking about, you know, not just gentle water lapping the coastline, but
talking about
torrential.
Tsunamis here? Tsunamis?
Tsunamis. Yeah, tsunamis, really? Okay. That could have been 800 feet high.
My goodness.
Tremendous, you know, wave action against the, of course, the Earth, which pulverized the Earth into the sediments that we have today. Well, if something like that occurred, you would expect, for example, that the coastal regions would have a greater deposit of sediments than the interior regions. And any animals that were living on the landmass at the time would be running away from the coastal regions, because not only is the water, you know, coming in great walls of water, but of course you've got all the sediment and this mud that's being laid down at that time. So you should expect then, you know, from that model, that the central part of the United States, for example, would have much less sediment. And we're talking probably, you know, there's areas that have maybe 200 feet, maybe even less than that.
Yeah, as opposed to 2 miles on the East Coast, yeah.
Yeah, after 150 days, because the Bible tells us this, the whole earth was covered in water. But, you know, what happened from day one, for example, to that period of time? Well, the animals were coming into the central parts of, you know, America, for example, and they were able to survive for a period of time. But as the water started to come in, even into the, you know, central parts, you would have an accumulation, for example, of animals in certain parts of the United States and Canada. And in fact, this is exactly what this article describes, and it is exactly what we find. We find pockets of dinosaur remnants, for example. In the southern parts of Canada, because I was in Morden last year for an apple and corn festival. Well, there's a museum there, a natural history museum, and they have this giant mesiosaur called Bruce. And in that area, as well as other areas in the southern part of Canada, there's a high concentration of mesiosaurs. And the interesting thing that you find about the mesiosaurs is that you don't find any small mesiosaurs. The mesiosaurs that you find are all adults and are all big.
No babies.
So it's like the big guys could run away, but the smaller, younger mesiosaurs got washed away earlier in the in the process. Mm-hmm. And that's what you find. I mean, that's what you find in the deposits. And so it's a pretty interesting, story. And it all fits together if you look at it from a creation point of view. And if you look at it from actually what the Bible has to say about, what happened at the time of the flood, and that there was not just a local flood, as some people like to say, but this was a global flood, and it affected us over here in America as it did in Europe, as it did in the Middle East, and as it did in Asia. It affected the whole earth and completely transformed the earth prior to the flood and post flood. The post flood earth looked completely different. It wasn't this one big landmass, a supercontinent called Pangaea anymore. It had broken up into the continents that we had today. And over a period of time, probably between 500 to maybe 1,000 years, the continents finally stabilized. And as we've talked about previously, it was this mechanism of the continents moving apart and the continued volcanic activity, for example, that led to the Ice Age. And even the Ice Age can be easily explained as a direct result of the flood and the activity that was going on here on Earth.
Now, Don, is there a way to date the flood to be found in the sediment layers? Radioactive or some other system of dating when those sediments were laid down? Because that's another point of departure between evolution and creationism is the age of this thing. Scientists who purport evolution would say, well, the dinosaurs lived 65 million years ago. And if they were then covered by a flood, I mean, the flood itself would have happened, or maybe they would have some explanation other than a global flood. Now, I've heard them talk about comets or meteorites impacting the oceans in various places that were spelled doom for the dinosaurs all over. Can we age the Great Flood by looking at those sediment layers?
Well, if you think about it, I mean, it's just rock that's been pulverized and broken up into, tiny, smaller particles. And the way that it's actually dated is just, you count the layers and you assume a certain age for, a layer, depending on how thick it is, which is, not very scientific. And sometimes you can find rocks in certain layers, and then you try to date the rocks via isotopic ratio technique. All of those, assume in the evolutionary model that it was laid down over an extended period of time. And it assumes a slow process. Mm-hmm. But if you have a not so slow process, if you have something that, happened over 500 to 1,000 years, for example, you can't really... date it. All you know is that this layer was laid down before this other layer. And so it fits nicely into the flood model, but you can't really date it based on the traditional methods for dating rocks, for example, or for dating what you find in the rocks, in this case, dinosaurs. Now, it is quite interesting that now that people are starting to look, and folks like Mike Armitage, for example, he's finding dinosaur pieces, for example, the Triceratops horn, which is, from all practical purposes, doesn't look that old, because it's got complete cells in it. It has the bone forming cells, for example. He's got some beautiful electron micrographs of complete cells. Blood vessels are still there. Soft tissue is still there. And if that specimen, for example, it was purported, you know, to be 50 million years old, there's no way of explaining why you would have any soft tissue left. People have also done DNA analysis, and you, by the fact that there is still DNA there, you can't explain that, because DNA is, as you know, is a tremendously large molecule, long molecule. And if you had a little you know, chromosome, for example, in your beaker, and you stirred it, you would break apart the DNA. So just by gentle stirring, you break apart the DNA. So how, why, you know, with oxygen and other things interacting with your sample, why would you think that it's going to stay around for 50 years? Well, I mean, 50 million years, excuse me. Well, you wouldn't, and there's no explanation for it other than it was deposited, you know, much in a much younger time than we actually think, and you know, the flood, according to scripture, and it was about 4,400 years ago, and so something that was, you know, laid down, let's say 4,000 years ago. Well, you might expect, if it was entrapped in mud, which is a lot of these things are found in, for example, that the soft tissue would be preserved in a triceratops horn, and especially with a mechanism like this, where those animals would stay alive a little bit longer than the first day of the flood, for example, because they're moving inland and have the ability to move inland. Then you would expect that, well, okay, this, even the findings that we're seeing on the soft tissues in dinosaurs corroborate the findings from a geological point of view.
You know what's interesting to me, and this really has nothing to do with science, it's more to do with logic and just a rational process. It seems when you start with the evolutionary model and you attempt to explain what you see on Earth, you get some pretty outlandish explanations, and you have to reach further and further to explain the data that you have in front of you. But if you adopt the flood model out of Scripture, then the evidence you see with your eyes tends to be explainable and falls into place. And to me, it makes the whole creation idea a much more winsome theory or approach to creation than the evolutionary model. Do you see it that way?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this, for example, the in New Zealand, there is a mountain in New Zealand that's called Whale Mountain. I mean, okay, well, why is it called Whale Mountain? Well, because there's a lot of whale bones up on top of the mountain. And there's other parts of the world, for example, there was a book written, I don't remember the name of the book, but written relatively recently about a prehistoric fish that has fins that look more like feet. And so the author was trying to purport that, well, this fish climbed this mountain, and that's how this fish got deposited on, you know, the top of the mountain. I mean, that's ludicrous. I mean, if you think of, you know, the geological activity that was taking place at the time of the flood, the fish got trapped, you know, and then the mountain got uplifted as a result of the flood, and all of this, you know, didn't take a whole lot of time in a geological time frame. And so, you know, within a couple of hundred years, the land's drying out, and the poor fish that's stuck up there, of course, he gets trapped in mud, and years later, we find it, and then we say, aha, you see, this is a transitional fish. It's transitioning from out of the ocean and into land, and it walked up the mountain. Which model seems more realistic? That fish just happens to have, you know, the little fins that kind of resemble limbs. Mm-hmm. And it happened to get trapped during the flood, for example, and that particular part of Earth got uplifted, you know, after the flood, as the waters receded off the face of the Earth.
Now you bring up another point here, and that's this issue of geologic time, and geologic time for eons. That's an interesting way to put it. Has been thought of as taking tens of thousands or even millions of years for geologic formations to form and to crumble and to reform and mountain ranges to be uplifted. We've had some fairly recent evidence of such things happening in a very rapid or short span of time, haven't we? Including sediments preserving fossils.
We have, and we've got a little—not little. It's a—it's a pretty big area called Mount St. Helens. I mean, mm-hmm. that is a more recent example of what a catastrophe can do to the surrounding area. And you know, of course, you know, the volcano erupted. Mount St. Helens erupted in the 1980s. And there was a frozen lake on top of the volcano. The lake, you know, melts as the volcano is erupting, and you know, one side of the mountain, for example, blew off, and all that water came rushing down, you know, at one time. Well, it took with it millions, thousands, if not millions, of trees with it, and it kind of scraped the surface of the earth and side of the mountain, for example, and many of those trees wound up, you know, covering Mirror Lake down at the bottom of the volcano. Well, over, you know, not too long a time, the trees actually began to sink. Now, they didn't sink horizontally. They sank vertically because the base of the tree is heavier than the top of the tree. And pretty soon, at the bottom of Mirror Lake, you had these trees that were in different layers of mud, which was laid down within minutes after this event. If you go under there, you can take pictures of the trees petrifying, and it looks like a mini petrified forest is being formed in Mirror Lake. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, you know, mirrors different parts of the United States and the world where we find petrified forests, for example, in Yellowstone National Forest Park, for example, and other mm-hmm. parts of the United States where you know, we can see petrified forests. It's not too hard to make the connection. Well, that in order to have a petrified forest, you need water, and you need a lot of it, and the trees need to be, the tree didn't just grow at that spot. It was actually deposited there from a flood, and the different layers that the trees are in doesn't tell you how long, you know, the trees have been there. It just tells you that, okay, the mud was laid down in different times in different layers, and some trees sank before other trees, and you know, you got, but the same process was involved.
Well, the point is, things that scientists used to think took millennia can happen in centuries or even in years, and there have been recent examples of fossils being formed in a matter of weeks in layers of sediment.
It just takes the right conditions, mm-hmm. and it takes you can't have for example, just a fossil of a leaf or a fish, for example. You can't have a fossil unless that animal or plant was covered in mud in a very quick period of time, because a dead animal on the surface of the water is going to decay, and then it's not going to sink down to the bottom. Mm-hmm. The bones eventually will sink down to the bottom, but the remains of the fish, for example, as you know, any fish that just experience with fish dying in, you know, in a lake or you know, in the ocean because of some, you know, natural phenomena taking place or toxicity, the fish float to the surface And then, you know, they decay. And then, you know, eventually, you know, the skeleton may sink down to the bottom. So you only get fossils if the specimen is covered very, very quickly in mud and, you know, is entrapped. And then the fossil can form, you know, into rock.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been looking around and on the web while you were talking to see if there's, because I noticed that Minnesota is in a portion of that particular map that's on the article in the ICR article. Very few dinosaur bones are found in Minnesota for whatever reason, and there are some that have been found down in the southwestern corner of the state. Something called a hardosaur, but not a complete one, just a portion. The other one that I found, I was looking up, you were talking about a book that suggested how whales got inland. There are stories and research pieces about whales that have been buried in sediment vertically, not horizontally.
Mm-hmm. Right.
which would certainly suggest that they didn't get there slowly. They got there rather quickly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then got stuck and couldn't move. And then there's another article here, too, about the there's a large picture article in National Geographic from a couple of years ago, 2010, that there's a whale burial graveyard found in the desert in Chile, at the Atacama Desert. And they found something like 20 or 25 whales within a half a mile. And it's, you know, it's about a half a mile from the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, there are places on Earth that are virtual laboratories for biologists. Mm. And I'm looking at this chart, this map on the article that we're talking about here. And David, you mentioned southwestern Minnesota. There's something called the Dinosaur Peninsula that goes diagonally from basically Lake Superior down to central New Mexico, which is where these concentrations of dinosaurs have been found, and then something called the pre-flood uplands into Canada. That means it's suggesting that the dinosaurs would have retreated to the north to avoid waters coming into their territory, and that would explain why more concentrations of fossils were found to the north than there are in the south. And it's a fascinating article. Dr. Tim Clary is the author, and we will link this article to our podcast that we'll have up on our website at brokenroadradio.com later this morning. And so you can take a look at this chart for yourself. And if you want to search for it ahead of time, it's Article 8531 at the Institute of Creation Research website. That's icr.org. I think you'll find it interesting. And, well, we've talked around this subject. It's nice to see these charts. Very helpful. It's radio. I wish I could hold this up.
Yeah, exactly.
And show it to everybody, but you'll see it if you link to it a little bit later on. Well, Don, I think it's interesting to note the change. There are scientists out there working on the creation side of things as opposed to the evolution side of things, and all we need to do is to get them heard. And of course, Creation Moments is a major voice in the country for science that supports a young earth creationist position. The website is creationmoments.com. Spell it all out and run in no spaces, just creationmoments.com, and you'll discover there just a wealth of resources, scientific articles and DVDs and videos that help explain that point of view as to the creation and the Great Flood. And I think you'll find it brings a whole lot of the puzzle pieces together into intelligible sections and pictures that can paint a very different picture for you. And my greatest grief in all this is that rather than the science being heard, establishment science tends to ridicule the source before it contends with the actual science. And as that seems to be where it stops. Don, you're fighting a good fight.
Well, we're trying to get the message out, mm-hmm. and unfortunately, sometimes the, you know, if you look at where the money is in this type of research, it's certainly not with the creationists. The creationists have to raise their own money, mm-hmm. Whereas a lot of the evolutionists, they belong to they're members of big universities and the governments are giving them grants, and so you know, their research is quite well funded, and you know, of course, they get their articles in the major journals, mm-hmm. where the major journals won't even touch research like mm-hmm. this.
Well, a good example of this whole divide in the world of science comes from our State of the Union address and from the president the other day, when he talked about global warming and mentioned that he has science on his side, the best scientists, he says.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's why there's well over 20 to 30,000 climatologists that have banded together to say that global warming is mm-hmm. a myth. Mm-hmm. So
and natural warming, yeah,
yeah,
yeah. I'm just reading more on this page from National Geographic. One of the ones that describes what's called a roadside attraction. And it says that it seems like the whales are lined up, but not necessarily all of them in the same direction. A lot of them are randomly oriented and you know, just kind of different in different directions, seeming to be that if their deaths may have been due to a storm or other event.
Yeah, well, try a tsunami as a result of the flood.
That'd do it. Yep. Yeah. Oh, look out for that whale.
Oh, there it is. Oh, look out. Look out. Here comes another one.
Yeah.
They found a large whale, a modern baleen whale skeleton. And it's a modern skeleton in Namibia, which is northern Africa. In the, you know, the head scratcher that they've got is that they found these whales that supposedly met their end 5 million years ago, but the whale hasn't evolved. The modern whale is practically the same as the one that's on the land.
That's how the evolutionists have to keep scratching their heads, wondering how this could be, and the other side, it just, well, of course, that's the way it ought to be. That's the way it was described. So, Dr. Don Clark, again, biochemist, member of the board of creationmoments.com, and always appreciate having you around, Don. It's good to hear a sensible voice for that side of the argument, and I'm still trying to find a sensible voice for the other one, though. We can get you together
which,
here. Well, so.
Which one is that?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, thank you, and it's been fun as usual.
Yeah. All right. We'll look forward to next week. And Dr. Don Clark of Creation Moments, thank you very much. And music now from Philip Kevren, his orchestra.